My name is Chris Main, M-A-I-N, and I'm with Brigadier S.E.E. Mores, M-O-R-R-E-S, who is with the Royal Canadian Horse Artillery to start with, and later went in as a troubleshooter, I guess, for artillery, the 21st Army Group before D-Day. The date today is 19 June 1979. And we're at Brigadier Morey's house across from Windsor Park on Curry Street in Old Bay, Victoria. Last day we got as far as preparations for D-Day, and you were explaining there was a number of difficulties with some of the guns. They weren't working, or some of the artillery. You were an artillery specialist. Some of the field guns and things just weren't working the way they were supposed to.
Well, no, the guns were all right at that point. The only problem was the leveling of the anti-aircraft guns on the Mulberry.
Ah, yes.
The concrete structures. Mm-hmm. They had to have devised some method of leveling in case when they sank these great craft, they weren't level.
So you have the three leveling.
So we devised the three leveling screw system, and that seemed to work all right.
They wouldn't tell you how many guns, is that right?
No, not. It took a bit of persuading. That was all very secret, of course.
When D-Day itself comes along, when did you go in to Europe?
Well, we were in London at the time. That was the headquarters of 21 Army Group. And we sent one representative over on D-Day just to see what he could see. He didn't see a great deal, other than very locally where he was, because he couldn't get about very much or do very much. And I myself went over later in June. I went to HQ British War Army because their sort of technical expert on the BRA's branch had been killed, and they just wanted somebody temporarily. So I was sent over to do that. And then
what would your rank be at this time, sir?
I was a lieutenant colonel.
You're a half colonel at this point.
Yeah. Okay. And then.
Well, when you went over, then you were to replace a fellow in 4 Army, is that right?
Yeah.
4th Army Group. What were their problems?
Well, their problems was, as I mentioned, I think last time, premature mostly. Particularly the 5.5 gun, having premature in the bore all the time, which of course strips the barrel and often kills some people of the detachment that are round about. And they had some with the 25 pounder too. And those were the main problems we had at that time.
There goes the dog. You alleviated that by what, slowing down the firing process?
Well, that was the case, I think, with the 25 pounders. It was one of the RHA regiments, and they prided themselves very much on the rapid rate of fire, which really wasn't necessary most of the time. And when they slowed that down, they didn't seem to have any more trouble with it.
And but the prematures. I remember the one was the striking arm. Was the oil congealing up.
Oh yes. Well, that was the that was misfires.
For
later in the winter.
I'm trying to remember how you fixed the.
I just told them to put the striker inside the battle dress blouse to keep it warm.
No, I meant the other one, the 5.5.
Well, we never really did know. We suspected it was the Mazak fuse. Met the zinc alloy fuse, but we were never absolutely sure of it. But we went out of production. We had to use up what we had because there was nothing else to replace it. It was either that or not firing at all. But later in the war, that problem seemed to disappear. And I always suspect it was those fuses. There's no absolute proof that it was.
What do you think, the fuses weren't they were going too quickly? Or
the metal probably cracked. They may not have been strong enough, I don't know. Because that fuse always, at least the prematures, were practically all of them with that particular fuse.
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily with the others.
Now, whereabouts would you be stationed in France then, with this group? Or would they be? Would they be on the move? Or?
Oh yes, yes, they were on the move. We were first near Caen, I guess, between Caen and Bayeux, mm-hmm. in that area, and until the breakthrough, and then of course we moved on.
You'd be in the bombardment on Caen itself?
Yes, yes, you could see that. Actually, I watched the Air Force bombardment, beautiful summer evening. I was sitting up on a hill and just watched them coming in, pouring all the stuff in.
What did you think of it?
Well, I don't know. I was wondering, really, how necessary it was. Because there didn't seem to be too much German activity in the town at that time, from what I could see from where I was. However, they were certainly about, and certainly blocked them.
Did you think you were out of a job with the Air Force taking over bombardment?
Oh, no. No.
No, worry about that, eh?
Don't worry about that. They could do a certain amount of bombardment, but they couldn't do the job that the guns do.
Why? Because the guns are more accurate?
They're more accurate, and they're shorter range. You see, the bombing from the air, a lot of it was pretty high-level bombing.
Mm-hmm.
From high up, and it wasn't all that accurate.
Patterning.
And they dropped some on headquarters of our own 3rd Division.
Mm-hmm.
That's where General Keller got very badly wounded, mm-hmm. by one of our own aircraft. And this happened occasionally, that they would bomb, just as occasionally a gun would fire short and land a shell amongst the infantry, which didn't please them very much.
In Europe itself, after the Caen, you just kept moving forward and...
Yes.
Trying to think...
We spent most of that winter, our headquarters were in Brussels. That's the winter of 44-45, mm-hmm. That's the last winter of the war.
And your particular task was to...
Same thing.
Just to keep guns working, eh?
Yeah.
Just keep the artillery going.
See what
going.
The problem was, if any. Going around visiting all the various units. Occasionally we'd get involved with enemy equipment. One day they said that they thought the Germans had produced a new tank that they'd hit. So we had to go up and have a look. We were handy, so they said, would you go and see if you can recognize
mm-hmm.
it? It wasn't as it happened, actually. It was one of the normal Tigers that they had. It was fairly new, but nothing unusual.
What did you think of the German 88?
It was a beautiful gun. Very nice gun. We should have had it long before, or something equivalent to our 17-pounder, you see, it came pretty close to it. That came along fairly late in the war.
Mm-hmm.
We had it in France, but should have had it a lot earlier.
Did you ever commandeer German 88s or things, or were they all destroyed by the time you got to them?
Oh, I think, we destroyed them. I mean, we didn't want them. We didn't have the ammunition for them, or the range tables, or anything else. I mean, they wouldn't have been any much help to us.
They would have been totally useless, I mean.
Yeah.
And then just destroy them and continue on.
Yes.
Now, how long did you stay with this group? Yeah, you said you were supposed to go in as a temporary. Did you stay with
them? No, I stayed with the headquarters for British Army just for a couple of weeks.
Uh-huh.
Then went back to my own, which was, at that point, our unit, that's the Wheat Chief unit, was also attached to headquarters for British Army. Because HQ 21 Army Group wasn't in the theater yet.
Oh, I see.
It was still in Portsmouth or wherever it was.
So this is why you stayed in Brussels over the winter, is that
correct? No. Then 21 Army Group were in.
Okay, I'm getting confused.
Yeah.
Okay. You went over originally.
In June.
In June.
And attached to 4 British Army.
Or British Army.
Yeah. For about 2 or 3 weeks. In the interim, my own unit, the Wheatsheaf unit, was mm-hmm. also had come over, and it was also attached to 4 British Army. So after I finished that particular job in the BRA's branch there, I moved back to my own group with whom I stayed the rest of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as HQ 21 Army Group came over, we moved to be fairly close to them, because they were our immediate boss, really.
Mm-hmm.
Although we had our own supply lines directly into the Ministry of Supply, so that if we wanted, if we saw there was something wrong, we could go straight to the design branch or the manufacturing branches and say, look, you've got to change this, or you've got to fix that. That was the theory of our main job, was that we could cut, instead of going all the way up through 21 Army Group, across to the War Office, across to the Ministry of Supply, and then all the way down to
mm-hmm.
the appropriate branch, we could go straight to the appropriate branch, straight into the Ministry of Supply.
So in essence, you could cut the red tape and...
Yes, and that's just a time-saving thing, and we were supposed to know, be able to tell the manufacturer or the designer what the problem was, and suggest possibly a line of attack to
mm-hmm.
improve it. That was our main function.
Now, you did this right up until VE Day, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And you were in Europe until VE Day?
Yes. It was a little after, before I actually left. And then I went to the experimental establishment at Chubrunes for a few months, just to have a look at the winding down, etc., and then came back to Canada.
What was the winding down process like?
Well, everybody was quite happy, and they carried out a few, some of the trials that they had on hand, they went on with, completed them and so on. Experimental work that they were doing, they completed. And of course, they're still going strong, still doing experimental
mm-hmm.
work. That's the place where they did all the firing for testing armor plate, or rather, armor-piercing shell against armor plate, range table firings to get build up range tables, and fragmentation trials to see how the shells exploded, and
mm-hmm.
exploded in little cells and contour and fragments
mm-hmm.
and see how far they went through, and used to use telephone books to see how far they penetrate.
That's weird. What was VE Day like for you?
Well, it was really rather fun because another chap and myself, a British officer, we were sent, there'd been a rumor that they'd had some rather queer electronic gear that they'd been making in Delft, in Holland. And we were told by intelligence that they'd heard this, and would we go and see? So we set off with our two little Jeeps, I guess, and our two drivers, and to go to Delft. Well, that meant going through the Canadian Army security screen, which was then advancing. This was about 2 days before VE Day. And so we went through Canadian Army, and they gave us permission to go through the advancing security screen. The fighting was pretty well over at this point. There wasn't much going on. So we went on, we got to Delft, and we got into this factory, and we look around, there was nothing in there of any interest, particularly with all normal. So we decided there was nothing there. And then this other chap said, well, you know, he was a very keen sailor. He said, before the war, he was supposed to be an awfully nice place to sail. Let's go and have a look and see if we can get a boat and have a sail this afternoon. It was a beautiful day. We knew the war was over at this point. This was the day before VE Day. May the 7th, was it? Forgotten. Yeah. So we went up to this little place called De Kaag, just north of The Hague. And sure enough, we were welcomed by the Dutch underground. And they had the German prisoners, at least some of them, all working away and
mm-hmm.
digging up mines, clearing the place up. And it was really very interesting because we met a lot of the underground. We met people that just had been hidden for maybe years, some of them. There was one pilot, and he had been a Dutch airline pilot, and he'd been He'd got escaped. And in his own house, they had a hole in the chimney where he lived, where they kept him for ages. There was another American that had been buried living underground for about 7 or 8 months, American flyer. And the local padre, we stayed in his house. He said, oh, we must come and stay in our house. You see, so we did. And he put us into a room. He said, in that room, he said, there's an entrance down. You can get down into the basement, see if you can find it. And we went all over this room. We couldn't find how to get out. And eventually he showed us. He moved this that way, and then something moved that way, and something else came in that way. And it eventually a cupboard opened. And you got in, there was a stairway down into the basement, which had been their arsenal, where he kept all the arms and weapons of the underground people. So it was very, very interesting in that way. They dug up bottles of gin that had been buried since the occupation. And it was quite intriguing. But one thing we did do, we did notice though, we stopped for lunch on the way, rather unthinkingly. And, you know, I sort of had a sandwich, rather crusty, but I threw it away. It was pounced on by a whole lot of little children. And we then realized, of course, they'd been sort of come around. They always did come around any military vehicle. That they were still half starved, which they were. And that was the last time we ever had any meals in public. We always waited till we were well out of sight of anyone, because we hadn't got enough food to give them all.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd had a very, very nasty time of it in Holland.
Well, there was a strong Nazi movement in Holland as well. Did you see any repercussions at all?
No, we didn't. I didn't think it was all that strong. Or it was perhaps more in the bigger towns.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get to go sailing, though? Huh?
Yes, we did. Yes, they produced a boat. They'd had boats all hidden away from the Germans, too, in the marshes.
Mm-hmm.
They brought out.
Isn't that incredible? So then VE Day itself was bottles appeared from nowhere.
Yes, they had rockets and fireworks. Where they got all the stuff from, it's incredible. But they had the most amazing collection of weapons and explosives.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, a lot of them they'd got from us.
Everyone out souvenir picking?
Not much, no.
No.
Not at that time, they went really.
Was that just for the occupation army?
Yeah, that was later. Yeah,
when you got back to Canada, what was your new assignment?
You came back, you went to Ottawa. What was I doing then? I was in the NGO branch.
Which is?
Master General of the Ordnance. It is no longer existent. There used to be the four branches, the General Staff, the QMG, the MGO, and the Adjutant General branches. They were the
mm-hmm.
four main army branches. And then they absorbed the NGO branch into the QMG branch. And I subsequently became the DQMG, that's Deputy QMG, in charge of design and development. So all equipment at that point came under me. Then I had five directorates dealing with different phases.
Now, would you be promoted here? Or?
Yeah, I was a brigadier at that point.
So you were promoted.
But that was later. No, that was quite a lot later.
Okay, well, let's just get it in chronological order for Chris here. You come back in Ottawa, this would be what, late 45?
No, 46.
Early 46.
Yes. Yeah.
You get back home. I gather you had some leave, and is that correct?
Yes, I would have had some leave. A month or so, I suppose.
And the Army and the Air Force, especially and the Navy, were winding down in the true sense, I guess they were.
Well, they were demobilizing.
Demobilizing
yes.
is the word, yes.
Yeah.
They were demobilizing and, you know, getting people back into civilian
yeah.
Dress and these type of things. Was that the primary concern for?
No, that didn't affect me at all. I had nothing to do with that.
Nothing to do with that at
no,
all.
No.
Now, there was a reversion day, I believe, was it from 46, where people who had come up, you know, quite rapidly in rank were to revert back. Now, did this happen to you at all?
No.
You no, kept your...
I think I've got to think back myself now. I was still a lieutenant colonel when I came back. Very shortly afterwards, I was made colonel, which I remained for a while. And then I went over to London on the joint staff there in 49. And then from there, I came back to Ottawa as a brigadier, as DQMG.
So you didn't have to revert from
no.
Colonel, half colonel to major.
No. Come on, Doug.
You went get this right now. You came back to Canada as a half colonel in 1946.
Six.
And shortly afterwards, were promoted to colonel.
Yes. As director of armament development, it was called then.
As director of armament development. You would not have regimental, now you were in the, I guess, not the general staff, but in headquarters, you
yes.
had less regiments. Would you have tabs or something, is that right?
Yes, you'd wear red tabs, but you did that as a colonel up, you'd say.
Colonel's up or red tabs
yes.
to indicate. The thing, I guess, is, what did you do? Because the Canadian forces and that were, as I say, they had lots of equipment and were winding down and...
We're still going on with development of equipment.
Still kept that up.
Yes.
What
did... You see, it was when I was in London, actually, that we started to change the rifle to the new and to the FN from the old Enfield.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very much involved in that in later days.
Well... What were the major projects?
Oh.
Just mentioned the FN. Do you fall off that?
No. Well, we were... Radar was still developing, and there was still a fair amount of atomic research, of course, going on. We
yes.
weren't doing it, but I was... All we needed to know was to keep track of it up to a certain extent.
Now, in 46-47, a single National Defense Headquarters is established. Are you involved with this business?
No.
You could still remain...
I still remain where I was.
Okay. And the... It's just the development of new weapons, new artillery, new... Yours was strictly an artillery base?
No, not at this time. It was anything and everything.
And are you allowed to talk about some
of
these things, I guess, is what I should ask you over here?
We were still working very closely with the states, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And we got involved. Then the standardization program came along.
This would be preparation for NATO or after NATO?
This would be after NATO.
So we're talking 1949 now.
Yeah.
Well, in your first few years right after the war, was there a lot of vying for position in Ottawa? Was there a lot of that type of thing?
No, not that I saw.
It was just very smooth, orderly
yeah,
process.
It was quite smooth.
With NATO, you have standardization.
Yes, well, that can. When I went back to London in 49, and I was a Canadian representative on the Ordnance Board, which is a British organization.
Right.
And then I got involved with, and then I was also on the deputy army member on the joint staff in London. And then I got involved as one of our representatives on the military agency for standardization of NATO.
That must have been an absolute can of worms, standardization in NATO. How did you flip a coin to see what was going to go?
First of all, the NATO one, it was a lot of talk. I guess it did get somewhere. The main one was the ABC, that's America, Britain, and Canada. This started first. I guess I'm sort of getting slightly out chronologically. And the first thing we tried to work for was standardization of the small arm weapon and ammunition. Well, we didn't really get anywhere very much. The Americans always rejected anything that wasn't their own. This was a lot of problem, I thought. I may be wrong, but that was the impression we used to get.
Mm-hmm.
Something would come along, they'd put NIH, not invented here, on it, so it wouldn't go very far. We had a committee on standardization of screw threads, for example, and all these things. And they're very frustrating sort of things to get involved in, because it was like kicking a pillow, and I never got anywhere.
Well, the general concern, I guess, being that to standardize would mean to retool and whoever got the contract.
Yes, there'd be a lot of that. The rifle developed reasonably well, except the States wouldn't take it.
We did,
and the Brits did. And the object there was to make at least the ammunition interchangeable, so that our Canadian-manufactured ammunition could be fired in their rifles. Because this was always a problem before, was ammunition that wasn't interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
And it simplifies your whole supply lines if it becomes that way, you see, because then you can draw it from different sources. It obviously makes life much easier.
But Americans, together, we're still pushing the M16,
yes,
AR-15, whatever they call them.
For the hand, yeah.
And they would be on a caliper basis as opposed to millimeters there. Like ours is 9
yes.
millimeters, is that correct?
Well, no, that's the pistol, was a 9 millimeter. The rifle was 7.62, I think. Was it 7.65? I forget now.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible.
And the Americans were still 38s and 45
yeah.
calibers and
yeah.
all this kind of thing. Hmm. Now, how far did you get on this? Did you succeed or...?
We succeeded up to a point, I think. We adopted the FN rifle and the Brits adopted it. And I think it's as far as I know now, it's pretty well interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
With theirs, and the ammunition is all reasonably interchangeable.
But the Americans were out of this, is that correct?
Yeah, I don't think they've adopted it. I think they've got their own. Well, I think it's the same caliber, but I don't think the ammunition is interchangeable.
It's a hell of a way to go into an alliance, eh?
Well, I can see their point in a way. They're so big, and their manufacturing capability is so large compared to ours. See, this is always the problem in Canada. We're so small that anything we would produce or develop had to be taken up by one of the two big countries, because we couldn't do it on our own, really.
Right.
And we developed the Ram tank in the war, but that got nowhere fast because, again, wasn't accepted by the other two. They had their own. Although we turned out quite a lot of them, they ended up mostly as sort of command tanks and opened up, and they were using them for SP mounts for the 25 pounder and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if we normally manufactured the same size, whatever it was they needed. Well, 25 pounder guns we manufactured, of course, and ammunition for them and that sort of thing.
We have a marked increase in expenditure. Did you, during this period, 48, 49, 50, did you how should I put it, notice any increase in funds, or was it still difficult?
Funds were always a battle. You never could get all you wanted. And development work is so expensive. That's the trouble with it. You build a prototype vehicle or a prototype gun, it's going to cost you hundreds of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
Which, once it goes in production, of course, then the price drops right down per piece. But the development of a thing is expensive. It's probably all got to be handmade, practically.
Mm-hmm. Like building a car.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. I mean,
you know, piece by piece.
Piece by piece. It takes a long time and it's very expensive.
$2 million Volkswagen on the road.
Yes.
The only one, too.
Yeah.
What about the Air Force? No, they were getting an awful lot of money and they had a lot of new developments and they're having new planes and all kinds of new toys, I guess if we could put it that way, coming through. Was there any resentment or feeling, or did you know about them at this time?
No, not particularly, I don't think. I think we all realized what was needed. Were they in, if they needed them.
How did you feel about NATO and how did your colleagues feel about NATO?
I think we thought it was a very good idea. But we certainly needed something of that sort.
What about NORAD, which comes in later?
NORAD I never really had much to do with. I think it's very sound. Obviously, it's a good thing. This is a hell of a big country to try and protect without help from the United States.
Well, that's the Canadian defense objective, is to protect Canada.
Yeah.
And you need every citizen with a gun, I guess, to do it.
Think also it's an objective of the states is to protect Canada, because they certainly wouldn't want a hostile country in Canada.
No.
They wouldn't like the thought that the Russians could come down through Canada on top of them. They'd just as soon stop them before they got here.
Yeah.
So I think they would always help us in that way.
What was the social life in Ottawa like as a brigadier after the war?
After the war, it was very pleasant. There was a lot of social life, I think. You get involved a little, but on the diplomatic net, you know, get invited to parties, and military attaches are always inviting people to cocktail parties and that sort of thing, getting quite a few of those. Not too many,